This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells with the MagicWordPodcast.com. I want to thank you guys very much for tuning in and listening to the Magic Word Podcast during this past year, and I want to be the first to wish you a Happy New Year, this being December 31st when this podcast is being released, and I hope that this coming year is going to be a wonderful one for you as well. During this past year, we've had a lot of ups and downs, and one of the things that I posted on this week's blog on the website at themagicwordpodcast.com is a listing of those who have gone on before. Specifically, it's the Magician's Valhalla. There have been many people who are friends of ours who we've lost during this past year, and so I've listed several of their names. It's not complete, but if you have any that you feel that were omitted, please add them to the list on the bottom. If you would just go ahead and you can sign in and just leave a comment on the bottom to say, hey, don't forget that so-and-so had also died this past year as well. We thank them for their contributions to our magic community, and I hope that we continue to build on the shoulders of these giants. And this week, we're actually following up on something that was started just recently, and that was something that seems to be a little controversy. Specifically, that Greg Wilson had talked with us on the podcast here about some accusations that had been made towards him, and that he was basically trying to defend himself and saying that where are these people and where's the proof, etc., etc. Well, the person who was at the epicenter of it all was Apollo Robbins. I did not want to go out and start the controversy, but I would like to certainly hear the other side of the story. And shortly after the podcast was released, I heard from Apollo Robbins, who said he wouldn't mind being on the podcast to give his side of the story. But it was pretty much with the proviso that it's not necessarily a defense of what he has done and his perspective, but also a wish and a hope that we will go forward prospectively and see if we can start a discussion within our community that's been long overdue. And that is something that has to do then with thievery and entitlement. That is, those people who go out and actually take other people's ideas and promote them as, or maybe even market them as if they're their own, as well as entitlement, which that some people feel that just because it's on the internet or it's been published that it is free, or that someone has shared a private idea with them that it's free for them to use. So, this week on the Magic Word Podcast, we will present Apollo Robbins. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and today I want to welcome as my guest Mr. Apollo Robbins. Hi there, Apollo.
Hello, sir.
I wanted just to chat with you a little bit. I have been watching you from time to time. I have recorded on my DVR Brain Games, and I was watching you on that. You were on that for how many seasons? One or two seasons?
I was a supervising producer on the second, what they call the second season, mm-hmm. and I was a consultant on the first season, which was basically four kind of specials.
Yeah, and then they continued on. I noticed, I think Eric LeCurc is on that now.
Yeah, they use a few different guest spots, mm-hmm. and Jason Silver continues to be the main host on it.
Right.
And it's really nice. I like the exploration of using magic in that context, of making people more interested in psychology and how we think.
It really does make a lot of sense, and I really do enjoy that program because they give you little tests and everything, and it's an interactive television show, which I haven't ever seen before. It's kind of like watching one of Max Maven's DVDs or something, you know, or Copperfield would say, touch the screen or something like that, you know, yeah. Kind of a thing. So
that was always the challenge, is how do you find those that passively can work with an audience where they can't reach through the screen and do it, mm-hmm. but then also highlight how one person might think differently than the other. Well, I asked Max, actually, for advice on one of the pieces, and he was very helpful.
Yeah, and beyond that, it's not just the visual aspect, but also hearing. Like, certain people can hear different tones or different things like that. And then, of course, just visual illusions and negative images and everything like that. I mean, it's a fascinating show. Mm-hmm. How'd you get associated with that?
Well, initially the show was inspired by Steve and Susanna, Steven Matnick and Susanna Conde Martinez. Mm-hmm. And they wrote a book called Sleights of Mind, and they're both neuroscientists. And they were initially going to be the host, and the show was going to be launched regarding them. And change of production companies, evolution of those, it ended up moving into a different direction. And they asked myself to come in as a host. I was split on two different projects, then they brought in Jason Silva. But I had to work with Gary Kober and Adam to help create a lot of bits for that first season. So it's a lot of heavy lifting. So you really get to see the ins and outs of it.
Well, I could imagine, you know, like with television shows, certainly that something might get a green light, but it's really more of a yellow light. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, I think we're going to go this direction, but then we're going to change it up a little bit. I remember talking to Rick Lax, for an example, about that sci-fi series about the Wizard Wars, how that it was going to get started, and then they kind of said, ah, we're going to change the format a little bit, and then they brought in Penn and Teller before they even kicked off the first season. So I can imagine that there's a lot of frustration involved with that.
It's a learning experience. You know, I think the big thing is, for me, I was about kind of the principle of what the show would be, that can we convey science without making it fake? Because the tendency with reality TV shows is to take the shortcuts. And in magic, I feel that that's fine to a degree with people rewatching, rewinding. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to science, I don't think that you can fake the science if you really want to help people understand. And that became kind of the boundaries that we had to do as our mantras in creating that show. And the guys that were at the helm, Jerry and Adam, were really phenomenal. And that show got nominated for an Emmy its first season.
Really? Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I can say I'm a supervising producer on an Emmy-nominated show.
Wow. That's good on the credentials.
But what's more exciting to me is not about that as far as a resume, but that the show's concept, what was nominated for, was a new category called Outstanding Information Television.
Hmm.
And I like that idea that it would be a dangling carrot to tell other production companies, hey, why don't we try to create other shows that actually educate a range of people that are normally not interested in psychology or science? And we could use this as the impetus for that, to say, let's make a smart show instead of... And it led to me also not wanting to do shows that it's just about me. I've been offered a lot of TV shows, and I'm not taking them because they're just more about me-centric and entertaining people. And I'm really trying to figure out how can we affect culture and generation.
Well, it sounds like I was talking with Jason Latterman, something that he had said. He was working with a museum, I think, out in Los Angeles with a science project. And this was a couple of years ago when I was visiting with him about that. And this has been kind of an ongoing project. And I need to get back with him and touch base and spend some more time talking about it as well. But again, it's one of those things that educate people in the museum, I guess particularly children, trying to get them interested in science and how that magic correlates with science.
Yeah, and I think that it can simply be summarized by curiosity, because science is about asking questions. And if you can take that 25 degrees to the right off of just science, the idea of the scientific method of testing against your hypothesis when you want to believe something is really the secret to critical thinking. Just because I want to believe something doesn't mean it's true. So why don't I test against it to prove that it's true? And if it's not, then I'll find out. And if it's real, it'll survive.
Right. Huh. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, but you don't want to question or ask the question, how is that done? Some magicians will use science behind their magic. Let's say, like, I don't know, liquids, color-changing liquids or something. That's science, not magic. And there are some things, perhaps, that could go in that direction. But as far as something that's sleight of hand, yes?
I think what you just did was you tapped into the place I told you was a hard spot for me with doing the show, because that was always the area. How do you get them to ask questions without asking the wrong questions? And that was always the brackets we had to do. Is how do we lead them to be curious? Like, how does this affect my thinking versus how does it affect my method? And for me, I was trying to preach the method is generally irrelevant. While there are great things and lessons to be learned, I don't want to spoon feed an audience how a method works.
So are you more, I guess, talking about the importance of, in this case, presentation or science, in this case, I guess, than the method? I mean, in other words, the method's not important. I've heard magicians say that too. It's like, well, I can use any method or whatever. I'm an entertainer. I'm not a magician. I try to push that part of it.
I'm saying a different thing, I think. I'm not worried about presentation in that sense. What I'm thinking is more, you could teach somebody about confirmation bias and logical fallacies and straw man ruses. And those labels sound very dry and uninteresting. But if I do something to you just because I have two objects, one in each hand, and I make it seem like you're winning every time, you're going to suffer from confirmation bias just because you keep on winning and you don't ask questions as long as you're winning. You ask questions when you lose and you wonder why you're losing. And that's a great demonstration of confirmation bias with a very simple kind of bit. Hmm. And I think there's these great little simple lessons that pull us down to not the complex compounding assumption stacking that we do in our normal magic that counteract traditional logic, but instead they go into the nuance of very simple examples, like maybe a dice bomb or a ball and vase, and that they can show two or three principles, and you don't have to expose them. You can show that, like, attention can be attacked in either two ways, really. It can either be diverted or it can be overwhelmed. And we capitalize on all these all the time, and I don't have to tell you how I'm doing those to convey that idea.
But do you think some people, a little bit of what I heard in there, are you saying that people would not question if they are losing, but they would if, I'm sorry, if they're winning, but they would if they're losing? In other words, yes. If you were flipping a two-headed nickel and you keep winning all the time, you're going to say, this is great. However, if you kept losing all the time, you're going to say, why am I losing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes if it's one layer like that, like the nickel, and they're doing it themselves, they will naturally begin to ask the questions. But if it's somebody else that's doing it and they believe, and now you add a pendulum over the top of that, and there's a false causal relationship of why the pendulum is making a circle, and they believe that that's tapping into their intuition and it's bypassing their logic, or like Daniel Kahneman's system one, system two, it violates what you're conscious of. If they believe that, that there's a false relationship of something that is giving them real information, the system, then they'll start reinforcing what they want to believe, their actions are positive.
Yeah.
And that's something that's applicable to politics, to investment, to a lot of other areas.
I guess that seems that's why it's natural for this network, National Geographic or Nat Geo, that it is hosting that, being science as it is. Now, was that the network that was always interested in this, or did it move from...
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, it was their internal production company, which was National Geographic TV, and they were very involved with doing that. And I enjoyed the project for a while, but there is a shallow barrel there that at the point you're asking the questions of what new research is there, what do we have to create, do we have to make something up, and or do we have to start tearing apart magic tricks? And I didn't want to be on that ship any longer,
right. So
I stepped off earlier than later.
Right, right. Well, you had moved from Las Vegas to Los Angeles. And are you finding it there, obviously, I would think, more opportunities in the media, particularly film media out there?
Honestly, my move here had nothing to do with career. I was moving here specifically because it didn't. I told myself I'm allergic to the fever that some people get of pursuing fame. And I moved here because it was closer to my wife's family. She wanted to be able to see them on a regular basis. And if we have kids, we could be very close to them. And I've deliberately not tried to network and socialize here. I do have a couple of projects that happen. They say, hey, if you're in the area, can we do this? I've done a little bit, but I'm not out there marketing myself. I'm not pushing it. I'm fortunate that I'm in a position where I have projects that come into me on a regular basis, and I can be rather selective about those. And a lot of times I'll hand those off to different people that I think they'd be better for. Because I'm more interested right now, when I die, what do I leave behind? And that's what I'm trying to do now.
That's interesting. A lot of young people don't think of that. It's not until later in life to look back and say, well, what legacy have I left? What have I done? Rather than being proactive when you're younger of saying, well, I want to do something for the community or leave something behind and actually make a mark that's important. In fact, I had run for the school board before I even had children. My wife and I were married, and people were asking, well, why would you run for the school board without even having children? And I was saying, because this way I don't really have an agenda. There's something that I feel like that the school has been good to me, and I want to give back, and I want to work with the teachers and make sure that they're going to have their union is going to work and they can get paid equitably with the rest. And anyhow, different reasons. I ended up winning that election, in fact, but it was part of my long-term strategy. And I was in my 20s at the time of saying that I want to give back to the community. And so I think there are too few people doing what you're suggesting right there of thinking about what you can give back and what is your legacy.
it's a bit of a luxury to a degree. It's something that you, my father was somebody who did that early in his life with his ministry, that he chose to sacrifice being pastor of a church and go out and work for government subsidized housing and single parent families and help people that were homeless at the cost of just taking a regular part-time job or a regular full-time job and digging ditches. Mm-hmm. So he was doing that, moonlighting as minister. And I saw him go through that life of not having the financial backing of that and working very hard in the situations. But I think some of that passed on to me, that now in this position where I have to maintain a certain balance of the things that I do, but I try to, both my wife and I, we are partners in our work, and we try to design our work so that do we like the ethics of what this is going to do? And neither one of us is religious. We're both agnostic. So we do this more of a value system of, are there things that we can do to impact the future? Are there things that we can do, like right now in the political landscape, and the polarization is a terrible thing. But if you go back to what we just said a while ago about testing a hypothesis, mm-hmm. and you think of beliefs as hypotheses to be tested rather than sacred things to be treasured and guarded against, then you could have reasonable discussions, reasonable debates, and without people having the emotional kind of vitriol that you see right now.
Well, that's true. You say right now, actually, that's gone on from time immemorial, I think, with people saying this or that against somebody else and it getting into heated arguments that when emotions factor in instead of logic.
It's true, and logic and reasoning. I've always liked that quote that sometimes belief or faith can be the death of reason.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point, because people will be fighting for that particular side, well, like the Crusades have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a position, there's a recent statistic, if you believe in statistics, which they
I believe in 38% of it.
Exactly. That was said by Abraham Lincoln. I think that that becomes an interesting area, because if you take the recent research, they say, is that now more politically polarized than ever in history. Where does that come from? What's the sample group? All these types of things. We can tend to treat statistics and science as the new religion. You know, it can be, well, this study said this, so therefore we must, if I give you a hot cup of water and, or a hot drink and you hold it in your hand, you'll like it anymore. It's very easy to take these things out of context just because we want to believe them, and they're very seductive.
Right. Well, in speaking of ethics and statistics and all that kind of dancing around a little bit, I guess, of getting to a point that a couple of weeks ago when we had a podcast that was given by Gregory Wilson, where he had you pretty much at the epicenter of all of this, that I appreciate you being online to kind of talk about your position and kind of what your thoughts were on your side of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, and this isn't something that I'm motivated to do because of that, specifically, because otherwise it's a he said, he said.
Exactly.
But there's a word that I really like, but it's not very common. It's in social psychology. It's called a construal. And that's one individual's interpretation of reality. That reality is somewhere in the middle, and we all have percentages of that we bring in. And all of us would love to believe that our version, our construal, is the most accurate version of reality. And the way I think to improve that is the ability to question your own, because it's very easy to be offensive and to attack someone else's belief about that. But if you're really going to do it, I have to do what I preach. I have to be able to question my own beliefs about that. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why I'm doing this call with you is to go through that thought process in a recorded sense to address some of the things that Greg said. And to test the hypothesis of here's what I believe, here's what I remember about this.
Right.
To also explore the hypothesis of what if Greg isn't what I believe him to be? What if he is what he claims? And what are those positions? And I'm hoping to do that not about me and Greg, but that if this could be discussed reasonably without the kind of aggression that you usually say people have about these kinds of things, they're very emotionally connected, like
yes.
A trick or that's my move. And these are our babies. These are the things that we make our living with. There's things mm-hmm. that we hope give identity to us. And people become very emotional about them. And I think I'd like to try to give an example of something, another way to respond to that, and hopefully highlight some problems I think might be able to be resolved in the magic community.
Well, that'd be great. If ideally we can open up that discussion, that would be within the community that seems to be talked about in rumors or behind closed doors or just gossip or something. Basically, it's thievery and entitlement.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it seems like a lot of people within the community are thinking that I am entitled to this because it was published, it's free, or I saw it on YouTube. Well, just because you saw it on YouTube or heard this, I mean, it's kind of like Napster a few years ago whenever music was free. Well, it wasn't really free. People had paid for that at some point, and others were losing money as a result of it. And, you know, there is the financial side of this to look at, where that somebody would go in and have the research and development that at time that it takes to develop a product, and if after a period of time that they get discouraged and they feel like that they are not being compensated for their time and they're essentially being ripped off of something, then they're going to back out and of the community, and we lose something very important that would have been that person's creative style.
And I'll tell you that that's really, from my perspective, what happened to me, that I felt that happened. I felt that was something that was kind of a zeitgeist in the community that I didn't want to contribute to. I have a love affair with magic. It took me from a place that I didn't want to be into the place where I am now, a very happy, balanced life. And I would love to give back to it. I'd love to give back to the community. But unfortunately, I believe that sometimes what people want isn't what always is best for them. And the people, things that people focus on will be the secrets. And I think part of that has to do with, you know, it used to be even in magic that there was a lot more of a mentor-apprentice relationship of brick and mortar shops and of this guidance of how to think about things. And I was the benefit of that. And I was guided to do decisions that I didn't want to do that now when I look back, I really appreciate them. And I think that when those went away and the secrets become online, that you lose the mentorship and you lose those values and principles and scruples, and that people have a tendency to chase the secrets. And if they can't afford it, they say, well, I deserve this, or I have that entitlement you mentioned. And they're willing to take that from a download or to take it from the cheapest bidder, or even if it's something that maybe somebody didn't want out and somebody else knows about it and they put it out. So I know we have a limited amount of time. I can jump in with you a little bit on a perspective of what I have with my interaction and responsibility, if you like.
Or yeah, I would like to, and we can kind of get started where he did. One last thing I was just going to add to what we were talking about right here. I recall many years ago, when Bruce Servon had put out a book, and he had put it in the foreword of something about that, although I'm putting this out, this is not available for you to use.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of controversy about, well, wait a minute, what's the deal with that? And then he had to clarify that later, saying, well, if I'm working at a trade show and you are too, I should be the one who would be able to use this and not you. So I can kind of see that side of it then too. But sometimes if you put things out, then should it be available? I remember I was with Terry Seabrook some years ago, and we were going to the Academy of Magical Arts dinner and together. But the day before, the David Copperfield had on his TV show, Let's Burn a Deal. And that was something that he had gotten from Terry Seabrook. And Terry was saying, hey, I never talked with him about that. That was something that I hadn't shared to allow somebody. I mean, the product was out there. He had written it up, but it wasn't something that he had authorized for use on television. Yeah. And it had his name in the credits for it. And so the question is whether that was ethical or not. The two of them got together and they settled things and everybody was fine. But there was a lot of controversy about that at the time then, too. So.
Yeah, there's a metaphor of crabs in a bucket. Have you heard that one before?
I have not. No, what's that?
Supposedly crabs can jump out of the bucket they're usually in, but the reason they can't get out is because the other crabs will grab them and pull them back in.
Oh!
And that's an interesting kind of idea when you think about, is that what we want our community to be? Somebody that everybody's striving, trying to climb that ladder so they pull everybody back down in. And again, my things aren't about that element. I'm interested in the art form. I'm interested in how it can evolve forward. I'm not interested in kind of a internal incestuousness that can come from reinventing. And, you know, it's something that I had when I did a lecture tour with Shudagawa many years ago, and we did it about a year going around the world and doing the travel. And I realized very quickly that if I want to do this for a living, I'm going to have to generate new content. So how do I have the time to perform, do this content, and to make it something I'm proud of to give people? Mm-hmm. Or do I just make up things saying, this is a cool idea, let me put this out and let me sell some of that? And I didn't want to be that person that was constantly making things up and just because it was cool and it was novel and hoping people would buy it. Because to me, that's the incestuous. That's the...
I agree.
It de-evolves our magic. It's not working material, or like Mike Close used to have his worker series.
Right.
It's not that. It then becomes people striving to say, hey, I can do this and add this to it. I can make a new product or a new DVD. And people will think it's my, I get my attaboy on the back. And that comes down to a core. It's showing that a lot of magicians that pursue that path are extrinsically motivated. Personally, for me, I'm intrinsically. I have values and systems that I want to do that gratify myself.
Sure.
I don't need the attaboy from outside to tell me what that I'm better or good or that I'm famous.
You've reached more of the pinnacle of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, of self-actualization. Yes. You don't need that credit.
Yeah, I'm more interested in humanity and the issues that happen with politics. And are there the empowerment of myself and others to know that we can make a difference with certain things? How can we change elements of what's happening in the world? And those are bigger questions. My wife was a huge impact with all of this. I met her in 2004, and she really said, you know, a lot of these things you study could be applied to a much bigger area. If you look at she studied psychobiology, and she pulled me into that world. And, I mean, that's where I spend my time now. It's not really studying magic, per se, although I love it. It's more about a bigger impact.
Yeah.
But so I kind of go on tangents.
Well, yeah, let me kind of try and pull you back then a little bit over here to kind of get started, I guess, that he, being Gregory, had first started off, I guess, in talking about you because I had said something about, I remember seeing you on the Essential Magic Conference in Portugal with Luis de Matos, in which you were talking about putting things in people's pocket as a put pocket. He said, let me stop you right there. You know, that was my idea. That was something I had shared with him. I'd spent some time over with Apollo in his home, and he doesn't seem to recall that I had talked or shown him that. So maybe that might be a good place to start.
Yeah, I heard the podcast. I think a little bit, there's a slight variation there, more you say. I think the time that he said he spent in my home was about a trick that he had with a coin trick and adding in the watch deal with the shoulder thing that I do to that.
Oh, the coin on shoulder thing? Yeah, we talked about that, right?
It seems to be about the pit pocketing. And let me say this about the consoles, my version versus his. I understand this is my perspective, and I hope that your listeners do too. And as I say this, there could be flaws in it. But I'm going to try to state the things that I know as facts and then give them those as a perspective. Because just because I say something doesn't make it fact. But there are things that they can look at. For example, Eddie Joseph did a book called Body Living. Mm-hmm. And I collected a lot of these resources. I was motivated to get into pickpocketing from when I very first began in magic because I saw my brothers do some things when I was a kid that was illegal. And my first exposure to some of that was the Stars of Magic book. And there was a watch still inside of that. And then there's a gentleman in Kansas City named Gene Turner who did a really neat watch still I had heard about and some different things. And I met him later down the road about 4 years in and talked to him and tried to form a community and friendship, and we did. When I met Greg, he wasn't doing these types of things. He was trying to do a watch deal. And when you know more about this world, when you're really in it, there's a difference in the expertise. There's a certain kind of unclarity that people outside of it don't see. But
now, when you're saying in this world, you mean the pickpocketing world or the kind of the shady?
Kind of these things. Yeah. Like, for example, Ricky Dunn was a very prominent theatrical pickpocket in the States.
Right.
And he had a type of watch deal that he would do with an inside thumb steal.
Yes.
He would grab hold of somebody's wrist and he would steal it from the inside. He had several watch deals that he did, but one of them was this inside thumb steal. He called it the Mickey Mouse watch deal. And the reason why is that he didn't want to teach it, but he knew that several magicians were seeing it. And Whit Hayden, Jason Randall, a couple of them were asking him about this technique. And finally, he ended up teaching him a technique, which is just grabbing somebody's wrist from the inside, using your thumb and stealing and rotating the wrist. You see David Blaine doing it on TV. A lot of people think that that was the way to do it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask Ricky, he would tell you that the reason why he called it Mickey Mouse watch deal is he just wanted to see, he asked those people not to share it out to anybody, But it was not a good technique. He wanted to be able to see from across the room when somebody was grabbing somebody's wrist and twisting around in circles. And so it was kind of a joke that steel is not the way that it would normally be done.
I see.
And that aspect of it, when you start to know the details of these, when you look at Bora, he could do those, but they're in half moves. When you grab the wrist, mm-hmm. when you steal, you sneak and you do little bits. So you don't pinch the skin. You don't aggressively assault the person. It's not a squirrel climbing up a tree as you steal from him. And when I met Greg, he was doing something like that. He was doing the Mickey Mouse steal. He didn't know what that's what it was at that point. And he'd put his hand on somebody's face and on their forehead and say, "Be healed." And it was very entertaining the way he did it, kind of covering up their eyes with the palm of his hand as he's trying to do this with the thing. He said sometimes they get pinched. And I said, "Well, let me show you another way to approach that." And I showed him a different way of doing the steal. And this is a long time ago. I was 19, 20. And at that time, Greg was a hero to me. I was really excited to meet him. And he's somebody that I think is very seductive to a young magician as far as his abilities, his humor, and the balance of these things, and his creativity and his brilliance. And I'm not going to take any of those away from him because I still believe that he has those. But he has a different value system. His moral compass, I don't believe, points north. And that's my perspective, I'll say.
Based upon your experience of spending time with him?
Yeah. And there were contrasts. I mean, he used things that he talked about being a Christian, and my dad being a minister, and kind of playing the uncle kind of role in those things, yeah. saying that this was my grade A material and I shouldn't let this out to anybody or let anybody know about this routine I did with the coin shoulder. And I met him at his lecture that he was doing in Springfield, Missouri. And we had talked once before this because he was doing this DVD and he had this pin and cap routine. And at that point, there were no online trailers of it or anything back then. And I contacted him and said, "Can I talk to you about this? I'm really interested about this and it's not out in my area yet. But I'd like to talk to you, see if it works out." And he talked about the idea of what the phases were with the 1, 2, 3. And I reworked the handling and something on my own. So when we met, that's what was really the routine that he talks about this three thing with that coin off the head and coin on the watch. I never saw him do that, but mine did. Mine did the coin off the head, coin on the watch, and coin still. I had some lecture notes on it. And when I showed him that routine back then, and tried to improve the watch still, it wasn't in any way trying to guard it or anything. I was excited just to have him pay attention to it. And he stayed a couple extra days and spent the time with me. A couple years later, I moved to Vegas. And when I got in the Vegas community, they really didn't like him. And they really had a strong disdain for Greg, and they said that he was a thief and these kind of things.
And that was kind of new to you, I guess, at the time, because you had a different perspective, and when you got there, it was kind of like, well, why are you seeing him that way?
Yeah, completely. And he had just done a lecture in town, and he was great. I mean, he gave me credit about even the pin routine. He says, "By the way, this guy, you got to see him do this." He talked about the coin and shoulder routine that I did. He says, "It's great as impromptu." And he says, "And this pin routine that he does." So there was no problem at that point. I didn't see, but again, these aspects, it was exciting friendship.
Now, what year would this have been approximately?
I'm thinking it would have been around 95, okay. 95, 96. Okay. And there's a guy named John Jensen that asked to do a little spiral-bound book about watch deals. And he asked Greg to contribute a bunch of one-liners, because Greg was very good at that. And he asked for my coin and shoulder routine, and I put that in there. And at that time, I was financially having a lot of trouble, and I was doing anything I could get money. And I was like, "Sure, I'm happy to do it." Plus, I heard what everybody said. They said, "Put it in print. It's the best place to bury something is in print."
That's what Jay Marshall, I said, yeah.
Yeah. So I put that out then, and that's where I went. And, you know, this coin and shoulder routine was something that came to me by, I think that helps to kind of go where it came from, is that I've been familiar with Al Goshman's corner salt shaker routine, mm-hmm. and I would do it in restaurants. And when I looked at the Stars of Magic routine and learned the watch steal there, I wanted to use the corner, see if I could mix that misdirection with the corner salt shaker with that. And as I was trying to do it, I realized sitting at the table that if I had somebody reach forward, I could use their shoulder. to do the loads and do the repeating loads in the same maneuver. I had a background in some Aikido at that point, so I started using maneuvers of locking their hand to make it stay as a table, because I ended up working environments where my eyes wasn't sitting in where they were standing. And then I started incorporating other things for stealing from their body in general. And that's kind of the evolution of where it came from. Because some people haven't heard that far. So when Greg and I, in the situation, he was getting accused, it wasn't Bob Kohler. I didn't really know Bob Kohler very much. And I'd seen him a couple times. I knew he was in Vegas, but he wasn't.
Your paths really didn't cross and you didn't hang out.
Well, he wasn't the one. He wasn't the bird chiming around, as Greg was kind of inferring. He wasn't the Axis hub of evil. Bob was a worker who was out there working trade shows.
Sure.
And Greg was somebody who was doing close-up, who was trying to figure out how to make himself more of a stand-up performer and those kind of things back then. And that's really what he was really interested in. He's like, I'm trying to figure out how to do this. I'm trying to figure out how to do that. But then later, he had sent me a message, and it was a voicemail on my phone. And he said, I want to put out another version of this impromptu video, and I'd like to use this routine. I just want to confirm I'm going to go head forward with this. And I called back and I left a message and on his machine. And I said, hey, Greg, you'd said that was my grade A material, that I should do that. And I'm concerned because, Michael Amar, when his videos came out, he used a lot of other people with their permission, those things, but nobody really knew where that routine came from. And I say, if I ever do that, I'd like for people to know that routine came from me.
Mm-hmm.
And not get confused. And I never heard back. I never got any response back from him. But then his DVD came out. And I was working at Caesar's Magical Empire at that time. And I remember some of the guys came up, Joey Burton and a couple others, kind of almost gloating, said, so your buddy, did you see what he did? Your routine's out there. And it does feel a little bit like a punch to the gut.
Credit to you.
Yeah, I didn't know yet. I just heard that. So I hadn't seen it. I called him and just said, hey, Greg, just want to talk to you. I think there might have been miscommunication. And I pictured at that time that there could have been miscommunication. Maybe he didn't get the message on my answering machine or something like that. He just assumed he could leave one on mine and do it or whatever it was. There's no way I can prove that he heard the message that I left him.
Mm-hmm.
So I was willing to entertain that thought, even though I was bothered by it. But when I spoke to him, I was pretty shocked. He has a series of one-liners that he'll say, now knowing for a decade and a half or more, I hear the same thing. I'm happy that he recorded a lot of them, because most people that have had these interactions with him don't have those. But he's said about, Apollo, I have no idea what you're talking about. You have to understand that the amount of material that I generate is massive. And I have so many ideas in my notebooks and everything else that I don't even know what you're talking about with this routine. And he said, I said, Greg, you're joking, right? I said, I showed you this thing back in Missouri. I showed it to you here. And he goes, it must have been so incredibly inconsequential or
trivial or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I don't remember it. And that kind of an insult, that backhanded insult, was the first time I've ever seen that side of him. And I was then offended, because I was willing to entertain something until I heard that. And then I was alarmed. It feels like your kids didn't take it away from you, but also it's this idea of trust. And this became a problem. This became something that I was worried about. And then Magic Live was soon after that, and a bunch of people blacklisted him because I was his only advocate in Vegas. And then everybody started really, and he was wondering why nobody would talk to him. And it wasn't me going around. At that point, I had said, he said this to me, this is the response. And everybody just kind of said, okay, hands off. It's interesting, in nature, there's what's called reciprocal obligation. So with birds, there's a flock of birds and there's a predator coming in, and they all go down and they attack the flock. If one bird doesn't do that, then the next time the predator comes in, they won't stand up for that bird.
Hmm.
And I think there's an interesting correlation that that's kind of innate in human nature too, but it can also lead to a social justice, like what you see on Twitter with the kind of pitchforks and people attacking someone, which I think is what Greg is claiming, that he is this victim of circumstance. Just by happenstance, he's always in the crosshairs when somebody, he gets accused by these things, and he's been marred with a scarlet letter.
Well, when you were in Las Vegas and you were saying that all these people were against him, and for the first time you were kind of hearing a different side of him from what that you knew, I assume that some of these others must have had some of their own personal stories that they could relate to say this is the reason why. I mean, it wasn't because what I was hearing in Greg's content was that people are saying all these things, but they're not giving me any proof. They're saying, well, there is this proof, or that, well, you know what I'm talking about, or, you know, you have this reputation. Well, prove it. Show me something, you know, name something. And he was just saying that people don't have this, whereas he has a, quote, mountain of evidence, I guess, of lecture notes and dates and whatever, that he had created something. And everyone else is just kind of, it's just kind of a hearsay.
Well, red flagging in a con is something that a con man will do to say, I wouldn't, said, now, I'm naturally, I'm not going to, I wouldn't do this because I'm of this value system or this line of thought, and that's beyond my bounds to do this thing. So I was looking at doing this and making a dollar on it, like a car salesman might say this. I was looking at doing this percentage on this, but he's telling you the truth, that he's lying to you, but then he's holding it back. And it's kind of a bluff. So, for example, when you're saying that mountain of evidence that Greg says, I think it's a bluff. From my personal perspective,
interesting.
I've never seen him supply that. I hear him talk about it. It's a flag that he waves. To me, it's a red flag. And it's a bluff that he says he's got all that information. And he says that when John Lovick, I mean, you look at Chris Smith, John Lovick, all these guys, they were his dear friends back then. And they worked with him. Chris Smith was a partner with him at Magic. Mm-hmm. Smith. And those guys were very devout. And they were, when they heard about what happened to me, they were kind of like, nah, I don't believe it. And I thought it was a misunderstanding. And I questioned myself back then, too. And I was thinking, well, maybe it was something with the answer machines, those kind of things. And that was, it wasn't about the small routine for me. It was, I was asked later on to perform at the Magic Castle. And when I went to perform there, that this is about 2000, something like that. I was doing a pickpocket act, and it's the only time I performed there. And this kind of gives you the example of, I won't perform at the castle again because of people like Greg.
Okay.
And I was performing in the parlor, and I did this act. And that act, you can find clips of it on YouTube where it'll show flashes of a montage, and you'll see my kind of setup, where I had kind of a catalog case sitting in a chair off to my right, and I had a sign outside that said, not responsible for lost or stolen articles. I opened with this, kind of making some credit cards appear with this gimmick in my hand. And I had this metal detector that I would use, and I would bring people up, and I'd do this spoon kind of situation where they're body-loading spoons and things. And I had talked to Greg about elements of this in the past when we thought we were going along, and he'd do apologies saying, hey, can I get your permission to do this if I do a poker chip, and hey, can I make amends? And it wasn't that we were just enemies. You know, we were talking over those 3 or 4 years since that incident happened in the video.
Right.
What happened was pretty sneaky in that I mentioned to him about this body loading routine that I was doing with the metal detector and those things. And at that point, he didn't know what body loading was. He didn't know pickpocketing. He was trying to get into a circle of people that were Gene Turner, James Friedman, Bob Arno, myself, and a few others, and he really wanted in. And there was a guy, James Coates, that I accidentally let in. And those guys, when Greg met Gene Turner, he started using some of his watch to without the permission of Gene Turner to use it for the public. It's something that Gene Turner had guarded for many years since I was young. Other people were very cautious, saying, I don't know if I can trust these guys. James Cope made a whole series of DVDs about pickpocketing, and he didn't know how to pickpocket when we were there. His friend Bird did, but he didn't. And put all this stuff out, and they just faked the people that were doing it. And it was disheartening back then, but I was learning lessons very quickly about how the magic community kind of worked with these people to get between them and what they want. And many years later, James Coates had gone through personal issues, and he called me and he said, listen, I'm really sorry. I was really ambitious back then. I did some things I shouldn't have. And he apologized. And that makes all the difference, right? Just to accept and say, I shouldn't have done this, and it was wrong, and now I see that. But Greg never has done that. He's always equivocated. He doesn't admit to any of these things.
And so you were saying, working in the parlor, that you had this routine that you were doing and you haven't done since.
Well, yeah. So in talking to him, I had told him about the idea of the metal detector, and that I was trying to get Tom Bergoon to get permission for a joke. I was going to ask Tom Bergoon for a gag to use for that. Right after that, apparently, he called Tom Bergoon, bought the rights to the gag exclusively, and I couldn't use it. And when I called Tom, I was rather shocked. I was like, I just talked to Greg 2 days ago.
Wait a minute, so Tom got it from you and then sold it?
It was a gag that Tom Bergoon did, and it was just a line that he used of having somebody guess which hand is a coin in, and somebody's being a difficult spectator. Then you turn around with a metal detector, wave it over, and it's like a bet.
And that was Tom's idea?
It is.
Okay.
And I didn't want to do it out of respect to Tom. I was going to ask him, and I told Greg about it, and I was going to tie it in with my body loading. So Greg calls Tom and buys the exclusive rights to it, so I can't. Tom says, I can't do that. Greg just bought it a couple of days ago. And that was another one of those kind of hits. It's like, geez, I got to be really careful talking to this guy, Greg.
I see.
And then I'm performing at the castle in the parlor, and Greg comes up after my show. And I didn't know I was greeting people as they were walking out of the theater. And I turn, and he's in my catalog bag, and he's got my gimmick that makes the cards appear in his hands. And
wow.
I mean, to me, it's the gall of reaching in there. And he kind of played it off. He says, what, you're afraid I'm going to steal something? And I said, get your hands off my stuff.
It's private. It's not your stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's my personal zone. Get out.
Yeah.
And he left, and we had to reset. The show came back in, and my metal detector was gone. And it's a pain in the ass to find those. It's not like there was an Amazon back then.
Right.
And I didn't have it for my next shows. And when I went to Japan on the tour after that, I didn't have my metal detector. And do I know if he took it for – I mean, the fact is I had it in a bit beforehand. I didn't put anything backstage, and it was gone after he had been in my bag. He began using it, and he began using one in his show after that. He did the spoon loading. I saw him perform at the castle. And he had the catalog case. He had the sign. And the way that I used to close that act was I would do a credit card in the sock, not mine at all. Carl Claudier's.
Claudier, right.
Yeah, and – mine was just with a credit card. I'd do a wallet, and I would stand up on a chair, and I'd say to the audience, earlier in the show, I said, I never keep my credit card in my wallet. I always keep it in my sock. But then later on, as a callback at the end of the show, a credit card's missing from somebody's wallet. I said, I never keep it in my wallet. I always keep it in my. And the audience goes, no. And then they go, sock. And they complete it.
Right, they complete the sentence.
Yeah, and I stand up, and the credit card's in my sock. Well, I saw Greg do this at the castle. And there was a nice addition in that it wasn't just in the sock. It was in like a little ankle wallet inside of – so he pulls down the sock and it's inside his ankle wallet. And I thought, great addition, but all of these aspects came from my – and I tried to make a piece and said, you know, I want to give you this whole thing I just saw, and I want you to know that I'm going to let this off my back, and I'm going to call it – I'm not going to hold on to this thing between me and you anymore. And he goes, what are you talking about? He says, this is all mine. This is material I've been doing for years. And I said, Greg, you were at my close-up. He says, and then he did the same thing of this. It must have been so remarkable that I've forgotten. And he says, in fact, and then I told him, I said, we were videotaping and there's a shot of you in the audience. And he goes, well, yeah, I must have been asleep. And these kind of comments, and he changes his version of reality, which he accused me of. Ironically, he accuses me of the things that he does a lot.
Could be selective memory.
Well, not selective. It's adaptive.
Adaptive. Mm.
Yeah. Selective is to put brackets on it and conceal portions of it. His is adaptive to who his audience is and who he's speaking to. This is, again, my opinion, my perspective on it. So my bigger concerns, and I let all this go because there's something that happens if you get on the wrong side of Greg, and that's that he's very aggressive. He'll call, he'll barrage you in every medium and channel that he has to reach you, and he'll very ferociously attack you through massive emails, through a lot of different channels, and you just fatigue. You fatigue to it. In debate, there used to be a term called gish galloping. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not.
The idea of a gish gallop is that it's not legally allowed in debate, but if I say so much misinformation during my turn of speaking, that in your rebuttal to that, your breath is kind of taken away because your attention is now overwhelmed. How do you deal with all these different points?
You just don't know where to start because there is so much misinformation. It's like, wow, this is ridiculous.
It's like a DNS server attack and hacking.
Right,
signal to noise ratio. And you don't know how to grab the various elements. It's not a diversion. It's an overwhelming of your limited amount of attention. And how do you respond? So people become fatigued with this. And he does a level of shepherding. And I became concerned because people had heard about the incident with me, I would always be contacted by these people say, hey, I had this incident happen with Greg, and I lost this, and I really... And I would tell them, be cautious. Here was my experience. Here's what I believe. I can completely understand Greg's concern that I was this one that was sending out this information about him and damaging his reputation. But I was also concerned. They say there's three kinds of people. There's sheep, watchdogs, and wolves. And I've, from a very early age, been the one that my father taught me to stand up to the bully. And I began to think of Greg as that. He was a wolf in sheep's clothing. He wasn't the person that was the guy that markets. He was a false idol that we have in our community because it was on the backs of all the sheep that didn't have the channels to the information. And I started to realize that almost everything that I'd seen that he seemed to be his originality was hiding his sources. He was brilliant, and he is a brilliant creator, and I think he could have potentially been an amazing person to help people to really be a major contribution in our community. And I think he has in a nefarious way. But I think that he's done this on the backs of others and on using others and on pulling down those other crabs.
But when he is saying that he has kept silent for this since 2001, basically, so for the last 14 years, he really hasn't said anything, that's not exactly true from what you're saying, is that he has been, maybe not in a public forum, but at least on one-on-one, where he has been going back and attacking or pursuing or being aggressive towards you and others.
Lots of others. And so what I would do is I propose this idea of what I said in the beginning. If it's the constructal, and this is my version of reality, I'll throw out a couple kernels of things for you to look at. And if you want to test against it, you're somebody who's had a long history with Greg, and you're not on either side of it. But if you were to take a look at the different issues, these different pieces, and if listeners were interested, I think it could be not just about this debate between me and Greg, but to look at these facts and to say, let's take a look at the timeline. Some of these things are measurable. Let's ask Greg for those facts. And let's look into them, not because of just slandering one person, but what if I'm wrong? What if the other people that believe the way as I do are wrong? Then you have somebody that is a victim, that is a scarlet letter, that is a victim of a social shaming, and you get him clear from that. But if we're, and that's an injustice right by itself. But if we're not wrong and he is a predator, you also have a big problem. Because you have a community that's reinforcing this public figure that now in the future they will repeatedly have victims. And these victims, I can tell you, example, I'm going to drop a couple of names, but Cosmo Solano had a trick called International Pocket Change. And Greg released a version called Pocket Change. Cosmo had called me, he'd shown me this bit that he was working on. He was trying to keep it kind of quiet. He showed it to several people. And Banachek was asked to give a quote on it, and I said, you know, Banachek, I saw Cosmo had an effect a lot like this. And this got around back to Greg. Greg called Cosmo and said, and this sounds completely straight up. He says, Cosmo, I really want to talk to you about this. It sounds like there's some miscommunication about this. Why don't we go on Skype, look at what each other's version, settle this out, and make sure that we have something that's reasonable and make sure you feel good about this.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, to me, what a perfect solution. And Greg's very smart about doing these things. So they go on Skype. He goes to show his piece. Cosmo says, this is how I do it. Here's what the gimmick is. And Greg says, oh, that's a big relief. It's not the same thing as what I'm doing. He says, can I see what you're doing? He goes, you know, I thought I had it, but I lost it in my drawer somewhere. I'm not sure where it is. So In that way, Cosmo just showed his hand. He showed the making of his gimmick.
Right.
Showed all those things. And he says, it really gave me some peace of mind, Greg, just to know what it was. To see what this piece was. And Greg painted this picture of not being able to have it, not be able to access it. And he said, listen, what would be fair to you and Cosmo? And this would be good for you to talk to Cosmo about this, maybe.
Yeah.
Interview.
Maybe I can try and get a hold of him. Yeah.
Yeah. But he was to offer, he said, you know, I don't know. I prefer you not to put it out. I know that's not going to happen. Greg says, well, what if I give you an advance in the market that, I give you 6 months that you can sell yours in advance and there won't be any kind of price wars or anything. And he says, yeah, that'd be fine. He says, so what are you charging for? He goes, I'm going to charge $89, something like that. So instead, within 1 month, that ad comes out that Greg has for that product. And he does exactly half of the $80 price that Cosmo was going to do for his. So these kinds of things show the indicators of a very manipulative person. And the people that you look at, Ken Sands' magic shop in Orange County, California, where Greg basically cut his teeth, has known him for 25 years. And I was doing a lecture at Ken Sands' magic shop in Washoe. And Greg came in and started yelling at me during the lecture in front of everybody. And these aren't things that are just my words. These are things that he did. And so where'd you get that? Where'd you get that? He grabs me by the arm at the end of the lecture when we get ready to sell the stuff, pulls me out in the alley and starts yelling at me. And this went on for a couple of hours. He's not the passive sheep that he indicates that he is. And he's very aggressive. And if you talk to any of these people, I'm sure that you'll hear, they say, you know, every time I hear his name or I see his index, he constantly calls like once a year to say, hey, do you have a problem with me? Hey, I heard you're talking about me. And he kind of, it's kind of like what a pedophile would do, that they try to keep their victims in check. They shepherd their victims. And hey, want to make sure we're okay, everything good. And to me, that's just a predator. And I deal with a lot of con men. My wife and I had a company where we tried to give different kinds of thieves a second chance. And there is different levels of that, where there are people that are sociopathic and that can't quite help themselves.
Or bipolar.
Bipolar. There's lots of aspects to that. And in that way, the person isn't maybe fully accountable for all those actions. And I don't know what's going on in Greg's head. I'm not going to say that he has any kind of disability or put that on him. But what I will say is that I believe that he's a perpetrator and that he has victims in his wake. And those people are hesitant and nervous of how to do it. And they're thinking, maybe it was just me. Maybe I'm by myself. And that's why I'm doing this call with you and this piece, because I'm not afraid of Greg or any kind of intimidation or the calls that he will do. And I am that watchdog, and I love magic enough, and I love this community that I've seen other people step up and think that what he did is okay and continue to do those types of behaviors. And it did drive me away from the community. But when Greg did that podcast with you last week, he did something that he normally never does. And it's something that normally a common won't do, is that they don't allow themselves to be recorded because they like the ambiguity. He's recorded a version of what he said. And that's very hard for him now to lie or adjust about.
Because that's on the record.
It is on the record, and that's why I'm doing my version on the record. And that's why I was challenged, if you guys were open to go in and explore this, to go in and look at these pieces. And it's not just about drama or airing dirty laundry, but what if you could actually use this as a precedent for other types of magic, for people that do this type of thing, to say, you know, I really wouldn't like that kind of light shine on me. And I'm saying that Gregory Wilson is bluffing. He doesn't have the information that he says he does. And if he does, he's going to be very busy manufacturing it.
Well, there was that one occasion I think you had mentioned to me outside of this about creation of a document.
Can I say that on air?
I guess that would be fine, because I would like to follow up with Rob about this.
Yeah, so Rob Zabrecki again, these people come to me, and I don't go out around searching for the things with Greg. Said, hey, I had this incident with Greg about, I was doing a lecture for the magic community about the ABCs of magic. And Greg came up to me afterwards and said, hey, listen, in the past, 14 years ago or whatever the year, he always says some kind of time in the past that he's been working on this. And he's incredible at making things up on the fly. He's brilliant in this way. So I'm not slighting that. But he says, you know, I've been working on this. I've got all this material for this ABC, I really don't feel comfortable with this. I prefer you not. I want you to know this coming from me, that I have this lecture out there, and I have it on my laptop if you need to see it or something. And Rob's a really sweet guy and said, no, please, Greg, I'm not bothered by that. And then as they separated, John Lovick, who again was one of Greg's friends a long time ago, who's now more wary of him, came up and said, what did he just say to you? And he told him, Lovick told him,
Rob
told him the basic idea. Yeah. And he said, he said he has it on his laptop. Would you please give him a call and ask him to see it now? And Rob says, that's not really, I'm not into the confrontation. He says, but you could just say it this way. He says, you could say, you know, it would make me feel better. It would do this. So Rob calls Greg and said, you know, Greg, on second thought, I would like to see that. And Greg was rather flustered and said, no, well, I'm sorry, what? And again, this is all hearsay. I'm admitting this is hearsay coming from me. So I say, talk to Rob, talk to John Levy. Mm-hmm. But and finally, he got Greg to say, okay, I'll meet you in 20 minutes. So they met in the lobby of the hotel, and he shows him a laptop and opens it up, and he's got this document. But it's basically the alphabet. He's got a couple words like acting next to A and a couple things, a couple little one-liners and these things. And he says, yeah, mostly it's in my head, but these are my mnemonics. Remember these? He's kind of rationalizing why he didn't have this document really filled out. And John Levick had told something for Rob to do, which I think was pretty brilliant. He said, Rob, when you see this, click on the original file, hit Command-I, and look at the date of when it was formed and the time. And when he did, he says, can I just take a look at this? He saw that it was about 15 minutes before they met. And Greg flipped, and Rob had never seen the side of him. And I think this is a side that probably his podcast will inspire. He went ballistic. He yelled and he cussed and said he doesn't need this. He has millions of content. He doesn't need this company. And it just blew up. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to do. I think that there is somebody hiding underneath the veneer of this person, of Mr. Wilson, and I don't respect him, and I am here because I want other people to know about some of these methodologies. The reason I mentioned a Cosmos piece, because I'm guessing that a perpetrator uses the same toolbox more than once. So he might do this Skype session, he might do these kinds of overwhelming of people, and I want them to recognize if they see those symptoms, whether it's him or somebody else doing it. And I would like for our community to bond together a little bit more as a brother sisterhood and to protect so that they can keep some of the people that are creatives and to reinforce them and show respect for them and to have some of the mentor relationship and family that we should.
Right. That's a good idea. Well, again, I would like to contact these folks like Rob Zbrecki and John Lovick and others whom he had mentioned. And like you said, Chris Smith and some other people who Bob Kohler and others to see if they would be interested in coming on and giving their side of the story, because he, being Greg, had again thrown out a lot of names and a lot of quote facts, I guess, or from his perception of what the facts are, to see that other side and then kind of let the listener decide for themselves as to where this goes. Because as you said, it could be right or wrong, or there could be a gray area, a misunderstanding or something. But at least if there is a scarlet letter to be branded or to be removed, then that's going to be in the court of controversy, I guess, that people can hear and make a choice for themselves.
Yeah, and I think that it really is it. It's that hypothesis, right? I propose mm-hmm. two hypotheses. He's either that scarlet letter victim of coincidence, or he's that perpetrator.
Yeah.
But let's test it and find out. And let's let him put the facts out there and other facts come forward and take a look at those. And I try to be open-minded about it. Like, I'm hoping as a role model that the other people that feel strong feelings against Greg won't lash out, because I saw several people wanting to lash out on my behalf to defend me, and I'm not looking for that. I'm looking to have reasonable discussion about these things. And if you're able to do some of these and fill this in, and if you have listeners that want to hear this in the future, I'd be happy to go on another one with Greg and talk to him, because I think it'd be very colorful for a lot of people to see how he talks to me. And he might change his behavior a little bit when he's being recorded versus how he is on the phone. But I'm happy to poke that line and let you see what's underneath the surface, because I would like you guys to see it.
That could be an interesting way to conclude this after I've made a few investigative conversations with some others, and then towards the end of having the two of you perhaps come back together and have some sort of a hopefully civil conversation.
Sure.
To see how that comes out. But I too have had some emails and some contact of others since the podcast had come out, in which they had said to me, well, I want you to hear my side of the story, or hear my story. And they were not people who were even mentioned by Greg, but there are others in the community, just as you said when you went to Vegas, that he had been vilified. And there are people who are willing to come out and say, hey, you need to know this or that. And, I'm not trying to stir controversy. That's not at all what I want this podcast to be about. This is really, I've always thought of this as being really more of just a casual conversation between friends, or among friends when we have a lot of people together. I'd rather this be kind of like a, Kathy Lee and Hoda kind of a thing on the morning chat show, or Michael and what's her name?
Or Dick Cavett.
Yeah, exactly. Or Dick Cavett, where it's a civil conversation with friends, and not something. I'm not Jerry Springer. I'm not Maury Povich,
Right. But I think, I mean, I would, although it would be uncomfortable for me, in my belief, to have it completely uprooted and to be wrong, what an amazing thing it would be that over the last 15 to 18 years, if I were wrong, if this guy had been, then I would owe Greg a huge apology. And I'm willing to, although that doesn't feel right in my heart, I'm willing to consider that. And that's something that I think everybody has to be able to do. Yeah. Otherwise, you become a lynch mob of people going out to attack him.
Well, that's big of you.
It's not about choosing right or wrong. So the ability to entertain the hypothesis, to be able to look at it objectively. And I think this could be an interesting exploration.
It's a matter of keeping an open mind and for everybody to do the same thing.
Yep.
And just saying, look, this is my perspective. I don't want to have he said, she said, and then having innuendos. For an example, the story he told about Rob, I'd rather hear that directly from Rob, because he might say, well, it was just a little bit different than that. Actually, it wasn't the same, whatever it is, you know, that there might be some little nuance or whatever that might have a different perspective that, again, the listeners can kind of make their own choices. But rather than somebody talking about stories they've heard of somebody else, I'd rather have personal stories to say, this is my experience, just as you have shared.
Well, but I did those two stories, the one from Rob and the one from Cosmo. If they're willing to go on record, it'd be amazing to hear those things from them, not from me. And I hope that I didn't bias what they say here. But also, there's emails. I mean, Greg is not above blackmailing people. I mean, he tried those aspects with different people to say, if you do this, I know this about your family, and I'll put this out there.
Wow.
He's like I said, this shepherding is very aggressive that he does of these people that he calls. And these people will probably all get phone calls real quick of just saying, hey, I need to make sure you do this. Hey, what's the problem with this or that? I want to make sure everything's okay. So these things are going to happen underneath the surface after you put this on.
Interesting. Okay, well, we shall see.
I hope it helps. There is no benefit that I have from this. I do not financially gain. I'm not putting products on the market. I stay out of the magic community. I stay out of the gossip. But I am willing to step up for the group that I believe in. And I hope that I'm wrong. I hope that Greg's something else. But I also want to have this resolved. If there is this guy that's continually exploiting people and there's new people coming on the surface and he's setting a role model for other perpetrators to be like him,
right.
I want to get rid of it. Right. And I hope that this helps.
Good. Well, I again appreciate you coming on and setting the record straight, or at least having your side of the record to tell, because it was only a natural thing for him after coming on to, since you were at the epicenter again of his ire, for you to have responded. So I appreciate you coming on, and also certainly your perspective and your attitude.
So. There is one last thing I'll say.
Yeah.
And you had an amazing question that you asked him one point where he was saying, why would I do this? He says, I have all this material. Why would I ever do this thing? And you said, well, because you could financially benefit from it.
Right.
And he said, and he stammered there and said, but that's against my code. That's against my personal code of ethics.
Yeah, he said, because I know myself and I wouldn't do that.
Yes. And that's something that anybody who's lying would say. That's something that's immeasurable. It's not observable. And that's a very weak defense. I'm looking for some credible defense. I'm looking for, like he said, facts. The question is, I think him and I have different definitions of what facts mean. And I think also when he said, just shut up. Don't say anything. If I agree with him. I think a lot of people get in other people's business and they start to say things and create gossip. And I agree with that. But I also believe if you're a victim or you feel like you've been wronged, you need somebody to talk to. And we don't have the infrastructure set up in our community for that to happen. So I don't want people to be shut up by him or intimidated by him. So I also want to encourage people, if they feel like that, to speak out.
Yeah, we don't have a psychologist couch for magicians.
Right.
But they can go. So,
thank you for giving me this opportunity to respond back to that.
You're welcome.
It turns into something beneficial.
Thank you, Paula, very much. And just as we close, of course, as you know, that my podcast is called The Magic Word. So let me ask, what is important to you? You've said a lot of very important things here that are important to you. But how would you summarize that into a phrase, a word, or a philosophy? What's important to you?
To stay perpetually curious. And that's what I'm trying to do here, even when it's emotionally involved. I like to summarize it with a phrase. I say, ask new questions and question the old answers. And in this way, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to question my old answers and I'm trying to ask new questions.
That sounds great. Well, good. Thank you again, Apollo, for your words and your comments. And we'll kind of take it from here and make some other calls and let other people make their own decisions and see where it goes from here. And then maybe we can get back together with the two of you guys.
I'd be happy to.
So, until next time. For the Magic Word Podcast, that was Apollo Robbins, and this is Scotty out. So there you have it. There's Apollo Robbins and his response to some of the accusations that were made by Gregory Wilson, and I will pick up the gauntlet and contact those people whose names have been mentioned and see if they will come onto the podcast and present their side of the story. Again, I don't want to line up a bunch of people who are just trying to assassinate Gregory's character or anything like that. Let me point out again that this is not something I really want to get involved with from the standpoint of being a mediator. I don't mind being a moderator, but I don't want to be in a position where it's going to be like Jerry Springer Show or Maury Povich, where we're going to be calling out people and checking into all of their history to say, yes, you are a thief, or no, you are not a thief, or yes, you're a liar, or no, you're not a liar. You know, the DNA proves whatever. I don't want to get into all of that. But I do think that the podcast called Serial, which was immensely popular, was something interesting in which that they actually did a lot of detective work and sought week after week in order to go in and see if they can find some clues and some evidence and let the listeners make a decision from there. And so that's kind of what I'm intending to do. By contacting some of these people and letting them tell their side of the story, then you can make your decision as to what you think about Greg's defense. Well, again, I hope that you had a great year, and I hope that your holiday has been going well so far and that you have a happy new year. And as we go into this new year, I would also like to encourage you, if you have not subscribed to the Magic Word Podcast, be sure to go to our website at themagicwordpodcast.com. And there is a tab there in which that you can subscribe, and that way that you won't miss another podcast that's going to be coming up throughout this new year. We have a lot of things that are going to be in store for you, surprises that I'm not even aware of yet. We'll just kind of play it by ear and see what happens as we get into this next new year. Also, if you've not yet liked us on Facebook, now would be a good time to go and do that. We're rapidly approaching that 1,000 friends mark. We're just shy of that by a little bit, and so you could be the 1,000th person who friends the Magic Word on Facebook.com/TheMagicWordPodcast. And I would be remiss if I didn't add one last appeal for your financial support to TheMagicWordPodcast.com. You can give a one-time donation by clicking on the Donate Now PayPal button or visit patreon.com, that's patreon.com/themagicword, and watch a video, and you can pledge your monthly support there. We certainly appreciate you helping to defray our production costs here for the podcast. I also want to thank all those who are friends of the Magic Word who have donated over this past year. Thank you, guys. You've really kept this thing alive. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and Happy New Year. This is Scotty out.